Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is February 14th, 2019. Yes, we're spending our Valentine's Day recording a podcast. And this is episode 125. Politicos is the BC Politics Podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, leave us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott Lamboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, I think everyone's forgotten, but the clerk and sergeant at arms actually gave a reply to Plekis's report. There was also a throne speech here in British Columbia, and the Jody Wilson-Raybould SNC-Lavalin controversy continues to erupt. But first, as always, Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to British Columbia politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos enter the offer code CITIZEN to get access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, did anyone actually read the reply? I didn't until like this afternoon when I quickly read through the clerk's reply and then saw that the sergeant-at-arms had written an even longer reply and went, well, I read the cover story. But yeah, both Clerk Craig James and Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz had written detailed replies to the allegations in Daryl Plekis' report. Those got leaked to the media. I think last week we'd reported that they'd just finished their reports, but they weren't.
They'd been submitted right around the time we recorded. And I think it's either late that night or the next day where the Vancouver Sun had them and published them.
Which is fair enough. I think it's important that if you did spend the time to read Plekis' report, which again, I encourage you to do, you should also read the replies because they are fair comment and they're trying to defend their reputation. Both of them deny almost all of the allegations. At least Craig James admits, for example, to maybe spending a little too much on magazine subscriptions. Specifically, the bicycling ones weren't relevant to his role. And he will reimburse the legislature for that. But on as many other points as he could, he tried to deny the allegations, give justifications for them, talk about how things were signed off. Daryl Plekis never raised concerns about any of these, and overall just really highlight how this seems like a witch hunt and unfair. One of the things that came out in an interesting way, at least going through the Craig James reply, is I think he took exception to Plekis's characterization that he was somewhat of a BC Liberal shill. He talks about how he's never voted in a provincial election since taking on his role as a clerk. He purposely tries to be nonpartisan. Meanwhile, Plekis reportedly, quote, did not want to upset the NDP when they were discussing the rancorous house. I think we talked about this when we were talking about people referring to ministerial names, like the minister of gridlock and other deeply offensive mischaracterizations.
Unparliamentary language and all.
Apparently, Plekis also continually talked to James. James having been the former acting chief electoral officer, Plekis supposedly expressed a lot of concern about a recall campaign, and maybe that motivated his fear, and it seemed like he needed something to distract him or distract voters, and maybe that's a sort of motivation for this. He doesn't say it that explicitly, but it's kind of between the lines. But he does give reasons for a lot more of the specifics. I liked his explanation for why the legislature needed an equipment trailer and wood splitter. At a couple different points, he talks about going to conferences on disaster preparedness and making sure the legislature is ready for a big earthquake or some other disaster. And so he says, you know, there is a significant and concerted effort underway at the Legislative Assembly relating to business continuity, earthquake preparedness, and disaster recovery. He goes on to say, our research and discussions with other jurisdictions suggest that in a catastrophic event, people from the surrounding area, you know, downtown Victoria, and not just those in the Legislative Assembly, will be relying on us for help. This may include moving emergency items, agreed, cutting beams to rescue injured people, reasonable, and, quote, splitting wood to supply heat and light if there is not power.
You can also see it, but probably that's the sort of thing a chainsaw would be great for.
He does point out they did also buy chainsaws and other items, so it sounds like there are bins of emergency preparedness stuff sitting around the legislative grounds, which is reasonable. But this justification of the wood splitter is weird. And he does talk about it going through a committee in the Legislative Assembly and getting the sign off on the fact that it was sitting on his property. He said, "I was storing them well. Storage space at the legislature, including a concrete pad and path for the trailer, was being constructed. This was supposed to be a short-term proposition, but it dragged on. All of this was done in the open and known to many people." It kind of goes on to say, "I became frustrated at storing the trailer at my home because of its size." And in parentheses, he says, "I did not have the space. I live in a strata and not a rural property. And I arranged to have the trailer stored in an RV storage facility." Which, fine, but it's still bizarre. And like we've pointed out, a wood splitter to get that firewood won't be useful. And maybe they all come from the city?
Or maybe they'll have like a big bonfire on the lawn of the ledge. The building itself is apparently really seismically unsound and might not even be there after an earthquake. So you might not want to count on the two working fireplaces in the building still standing.
Well, but it's for the neighborhood. It's for the community. And it is reasonable to say that neighboring residents and maybe people in the hotels will go to the legislature because they will have a disaster plan, whereas most people don't. Which is a reminder, get yourself an earthquake kit. It does not need to include a wood splitter. James goes on and he talks about the trips he took, for example, saying the speaker not only approved of these itineraries, but he was enthusiastic about them. My recollection is his words were, quote, "I love it," with an exclamation mark. He talks about that in terms of the UK trip, the China trip, and others, and that Daryl was continually expressing his excitement about this three-year travel plan, and he was all on board with all the travel he could do as Speaker of the Legislature.
Well, not only that, in Lenz's document, he says that Plekis not only was enjoying it, but looked forward to traveling in first class on Dreamliners, and that Lenz was, you know, careful with government money and would always travel in economy class. So this was a step up for him accompanying the speaker.
Well, and James brought that up at a different point on the St. Andrews trip, the fancy golf course in Scotland, that was actually Daryl Plekis's idea, and they bought non-refundable tickets, so they had to go on it. And it's a he said, he said kind of situation where no one really knows what's going on. The gift shop purchases, for example, James claims were not for personal uses, but for, this is weird, I'm just going to quote him. He sort of lists three reasons he bought so much at gift shops. One is for precedence or merchandise for display at or sale at the Legislative Assembly's own gift shop. So he's sourcing items for the BC Legislature gift shop by going to other gift shops.
Yeah, it makes no sense. Like, the gift shop would have a purchaser who would, job would be to buy this stuff to stock in the gift shop. Like, it's why the senior most person basically at the legislature is doing it on his own trips makes no sense.
He has two other reasons. The second is he would buy prints to be framed for various offices or stationery to be used throughout the office. And there's probably cheaper ways to get stationery, but if you need a notepad or something, and decorating the legislature is a reasonable expense because we want it to look nice. And third is for protocol gifts or display in offices elsewhere in the Legislative Assembly. And the protocol gifts is actually the most legit kind of thing.
Yeah, although like the famous corruption watch from the House of Commons in the UK would be odd, because like, why would you give someone like a watch that has a different parliament on it?
So they talk about the watches, and he says there were three watches. Two were bought as retirement gifts, and they have a standing practice of buying senior staff members a fancy watch as a retirement gift, whether it's domestic or British, I don't know. And the third watch was apparently purchased at the specific direction of the speaker, and he says some of the cufflinks were also bought on the speaker's request. And so it's this, no, we weren't trying to overspend. Daryl Plekis was actually telling us to buy all these things. And it's another case where you can't really know who to trust. And maybe Plekis was wrong, but it's weird.
be a weird like 5D chess thing for Daryl Plekis to draw all this attention to his own improper spending and try and pin it on someone else. The most obvious explanation is not that Daryl Plekis was the one overspending and trying to shift the blame.
On the per diems, because that's one thing that Craig James specifically was spending a lot more on than either the other two. James says he was doing that as a practice often because he was buying meals for other people. And so while he may have been given free food, he was using his per diem to cover the things he was buying for a driver or an interpreter or other assistants who would be on the trip. And he was told to do that by the speaker himself, according to Craig James. So again, it's the speaker is pushing the spending that they had to do and then signing it all off. And James admits this was probably not the most above board practice and he should have done it a different way, but he thought it was all fine because it was the speaker's suggestion. But the luggage explanation was one of the weirder ones.
Yeah, so this is the famous, what was it, $1,100 set of luggage that was purchased on a trip in Hong Kong where it was alleged this expensive suitcase was bought and a single t-shirt was thrown in there to help justify it or something. It wasn't entirely clear in Plekis' report why the t-shirt also accompanied it, but the explanation for this purchase was that this is going to be put into a luggage pool for the legislature for MLAs to use.
And the idea itself, again, is somewhat reasonable. MLAs may get called away on trips spontaneously if like there's an emergency, and so having some luggage at the legislative assembly that anyone can just grab a suitcase, stuff their overnight stuff, and go up to Prince George or whatever.
Even so, you'd expect an MLA to have their own luggage. Like they do travel just because most of them represent places that aren't in Victoria, and they're paid well enough they would have their own luggage. But even so, would you necessarily get the most expensive luggage to be put in a communal luggage pool?
When you're not in Canada?
Yeah. Like, why don't you just go down to, like, Mayfair Shopping Center or something, or Uptown, or wherever you go in Victoria, and just pick something up if it's really that urgent?
And the other explanation that kind of left me scratching my head was on the noise-canceling headphones, these $500 Bose headphones. James says he suffers from a condition which causes ear problems when flying, arising from a combination of sound and cabin pressure. The noise-canceling headphones were purchased to alleviate that condition. I'm totally sympathetic to adaptive technologies or medically necessary devices, but usually those are accompanied with the doctor's note or some other proof. And I'm not saying he's lying about his condition. I suspect he is grossly uncomfortable when flying, and I have no reason to disbelieve that. But immediately jumping to fancy headphones must be purchased on the public dime. And he's paid well.
Yeah, not only is he paid well, but like, shouldn't this be the sort of thing that, you know, the medical plan for legislature employees cover?
Yes. So, I mean, there's lots more in there that we could cover, but I think we've touched on a bunch. It's sort of like Plekis report, where you get so much there that you're like, all right, some of this is reasonable and I can see your point of view there, but other of this is just doesn't make any sense. And trying to piece these counter narratives together into what is the reality, I'm still left feeling like the culture is to spend, approve, don't ask questions, and worry about, you know, the finances later.
Yeah, after both of these, the balance of probabilities for me still lies more on the Daryl Plekis side of things, in that the narrative presented in his bid report is probably more likely to be correct than what's in here.
All of this will be considered when Lamsey meets again on next Thursday, the 21st, and we'll have to see which side MLAs are going to believe. The rhetoric in the last couple weeks has all been increasingly partisan, as the NDP and Greens, I think, see this as to different levels as a way to go after the Liberals, and the Liberals just want to keep clear of all the shots being fired. Linda Reid has taken a bullet on this one already and resigned as Deputy Speaker, citing either her or Wilkinson, citing that it's hard, she couldn't do her job as Deputy Speaker given these allegations are sitting out there and the speaker's report. And I say it was definitely Wilkinson giving that because Reed was apparently caught running away from video cameras, TV cameras in the legislature halls, which is, many people pointed out, is not a good look, particularly for the longest serving MLA in the province. Like, you should learn that. Don't run from cameras. You can maybe walk. But she's out as deputy speaker. Joan Isaacs is put in her stead. But I think there's still more shoes to drop, as Alan Mullen has said. Or bombs to go off.
There's been several metaphors thrown around, and the one that's been pretty clear, or has been repeated a lot, is that there's still some stuff that the RCMP has that hasn't been made public yet, so no doubt we will be hearing more at some point.
Well, the thing that's been distracting most BC political watchers, I think, has been the return of the actual legislature itself, and snowstorm be damned, MLAs got together who needed to on the BC ferry because they couldn't take Helijet or Harbor Air, and had a little, you know, party on the ferry and then got to work, and there on Tuesday afternoon had the throne speech. Anything good in there?
A lot of it is just kind of reiterating the greatest hits of this government. Like, it was a pretty much a stay the course throne speech, nothing too new. They're going to be freezing some ferry fares, which, like, it's going to be popular with people on the islands. It's debatable on policy grounds whether or not we should be subsidizing transportation, but that's a question.
The question is, how much should we be subsidizing it? Yeah, the ferry fares were frozen the first year they got in, and freezing them again is... I don't take the ferry that much, so I'm not as affected, but I can see why it would be a popular move.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up on the island. Complaining about the ferries was one of the major pastimes.
I think the other big new affordability plank they rolled out in there is this move to go after unaffordable cell phone rates. Well, there's sort of two parts, and they're pocketbook things. Classic, like Jack Layton, NDP. Cell phone rates and, like, ticket scalpers. And so they're going to ban ticket buying bots as best they can.
That seems to be really hard to enforce.
It's an arms race, I heard it described as.
Well, not only that, like, the internet doesn't stop at the BC border.
Just as long as it gets a little easier to buy your Pink tickets. And I'm going to Pink next month in April when she comes back.
2 months.
So as long as that gets easier. The cell phone one is interesting because a lot of people were very quick to point out, including I think even you, that that's federal jurisdiction.
Yes, it is. Because telecommunications are a federally regulated industry. So the province is pretty limited on what it can do here. There are some levers they can use. Like, I think particularly around some of the commercial contract law sort of things is more a provincial issue, so they can just have general requirements around transparency and contracts and billing.
The Ontario government, I think the Kathleen Wynne in 2013, I had to look this up because some people had referenced that Ontario had done stuff, rolled out Ontario's Wireless Services Agreement Act. And it looks like Doug Ford is going to repeal that in his big Open Ontario for Business Again Act, which will also cut labor standards and a bunch of other things that is making all the unions and business regulation types scared.
I'm going to just go on a limb here and say probably the impediment to competition in the telecoms industry is not the Ontario regulations.
This regulation, though, specifically sort of added on to some existing protections at the federal level, but it did things like made sure contracts were written in plain language, even though people still probably won't read them. More importantly, it capped cancellation fees at $50, which is much better rate than sometimes, you know, the hundreds of dollars. Like, now you must pay out 3 years of contract. Requires consent before changing services, allows you to cancel your contract for free if you've been in it for 2 years. Kind of just makes that easier, makes the contracts less evil, which is hard to really disagree with if you've ever had to buy a cell phone contract in Canada. I buy my phone outright and then just go month to month. And it's great. I pay $40 a month and I get 4 gigs of data. I got a good secret deal. But so I could see the John Horgan NDP rolling out something like that.
Yeah, it might help a bit, like, but, you know, on the edges, because cell phones are stupid expensive in Canada. And like the one thing that does seem to have really made an impact anywhere in Canada is when there's a local competitor.
Like the MTS, which was a nationalized telecom service.
Yeah, or SaskTel. There's one Videotron in Quebec as well.
So if John Horgan's listening, he should be nationalizing a telecom. or at least building BC Tel back up.
As someone who's fairly anti-nationalization, yeah, telecoms is absolutely something that the government should be looking more into just because it is a natural monopoly.
Cool. Politicoast endorses nationalizing the telecoms. Did not see this coming. He also talks about rolling out in the throne speech legislation to implement UNDRIP. This was talked about in the fall, so it's not really a surprise, but it'll be good to see those bills come forward. And no one really knows what they're going to look like, even the premier. He's like, it might be one bill, it might be a whole bunch. We're waiting to find out. And so someone is thinking hard about that. He talked about childcare, of course, because that's part of the long rollout that the government has promised. And it sounds like there's going to be legislation we'll see to really put it into law. So it's not just fee subsidies, but there's actually some protections and guarantees of rights to childcare, which will be interesting to see. And then there was just like two lines right at the end of the throne speech about, I guess we should do something to improve accountability at the legislature. It was a little underwhelming.
That was probably added in a little later on. Like, I imagine these things have been in the works for several months, and, well, this kind of came out probably well into the process.
I mean, the pathways are pretty clear. I think we talked about last week the privacy commissioner and his friends setting out a whole bunch of recommendations. The Liberals have their laundry list. I mean, there's paths forward, and lots of people have said how the FOI system generally needs to be improved, but at very least you can extend that to Legislative Assembly staff. But you also wanted to talk about housing a little bit because it was in there.
Yeah. Well, one thing that caught my eye in there is they have a section on housing, and it's a lot of kind of the stuff they've already announced, you know, modular homes, that sort of thing. They're going to implement the rental task force recommendations we talked about several weeks ago. They also have a line in there about, what's the exact phrase? Will improve the development process by speeding up much-needed rentals and deliver more efficient and effective project approvals, which is municipal and, like, good. That is a big problem, but how is the provincial government going to do that?
I mean, they could change the community charter and Vancouver charter to take away some of that power, but that would seem to make a lot more enemies than friends.
That should have gotten higher billing as a major, you know, structural reform if that's going to happen. I mean, the provincial government should probably be doing something along those lines, but it is such a political hot potato that they probably won't.
A lot of people have been quick to point this out, but the real meat of the year will come out next week in the budget, as opposed to the throne speech, which even at its best of days is still a laundry list of lofty promises rather than specific tangible changes you can expect to see.
Yes.
Except that one time Harper put in the throne speech that he was going to change the anthem, and then conservative voters were like, no, you don't. And then he didn't. And then Trudeau changed the anthem.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. I pay attention to anthem changes. They're very important. So unsurprisingly, neither the opposition parties were too enthralled with the throne speech. The Liberals' reaction was basically characterized by Wilkinson's quote that there was nothing of substance in there.
Which is, it's the standard thing you say in opposition, because the throne speech is, like you said, a laundry list of things. And, you know, it still takes 45 minutes to deliver because you're hitting on like every major policy thing, which basically gives you a sentence on each of them.
And when I say, you know, it's a stay the course throne speech, there was still a lot of substance in it. Like, to say they're still keeping on with their plans and the Clean BC, for example, and all of that, there's a lot of substance in all of these projects. They're just not new substances. And I guess the Liberals' other concern is the economy is kind of shaky, and while BC's still doing great, best in the country, that could collapse at any point. And that's fair, and that kind of leads into Andrew Weaver's criticism that it's overall missing a broader vision, which I think the Greens want to see a sort of green, not a Green New Deal, but a, because that phrase is already way overused, but a eco-capitalism mixed market system, whatever the Green Party is. He likes Clean BC. He likes that idea of mixing economic incentives and the environment. But he, I guess, is critical that this throne speech overall doesn't do enough. I think it's just that the vision is more still that election pitch of affordable BC. Let's make life not cost so much.
It's actually mid-term throne speech. Like, if you're not going to do a big change of direction, like as a signal that, oh, we need to rethink our general path of, or direction of governments, like you generally don't put big things in this throne speech.
Yeah, you don't need to throw election goodies in there. Well, it is a minority government, and given they just lost the proportional representation vote, the idea could be that Horgan could angle for an election to try to get a full majority, but I think this suggests, no, they're happy. Better to wield the power you have than to risk it on more. The only other thing that came up this week in the actual legislature itself that I want to touch on right now is, oddly, in question period, it sounds like the Liberals have been already focused on ride-sharing, of all things. You know, they don't want to talk about spending scandals in the Legislative Assembly, I guess. And instead, they want to bring up, and I think I saw some MLAs and others tweeting from the Liberal side in the snowstorm, like, oh, if only Uber existed, we could make sure everyone was getting home safely when transit is down, which nothing says safe like putting more cars on the snowy roads, just driving around waiting to find people. Anyway, Liberals are all on about ride sharing, and in specific, they got really upset today that Parliamentary Secretary and NDP MLA Ravi Kalone, who I believe represents Delta, he is on the committee that's examining ride sharing legislation, and it turns out his father has a taxi license, so he's horribly conflicted on this issue and should be removed from the committee entirely.
It's not entirely unreasonable concern, because it is an immediate family member with a business interest in the industry that has been most vocal in the discussion.
The irony is that Ravi's probably been one of the more pro ride-sharing MLAs in the NDP's caucus. Like, he has a constituency and I think a younger vibe that supports that, and he's talked to people about how he wants to make sure it's brought in. His defense also is that he has raised this and mentioned it to some other MLAs, but on the committee, but hasn't maybe necessarily done it in the full proper, this is my conflict of interest, I should recuse myself.
Yesterday, he did send a letter to the conflict of interest commissioner about it, but like that was kind of around the point where the Liberals had started poking at it, so it's not entirely getting out ahead of it.
Yeah. It's not perfect optics, but then I think the Liberals were starting to get into the who else in your family is a cab driver, which gets a bit, not racially charged, but maybe, or at least classist. Like if you come from this poor, you know, minority ethnic community where most people are, or many people are cab drivers. I don't know. It's weird. I think it's a bit of a mountain out of a molehill, but I'm not a big Uber fan, so I have trouble ginning up the outrage at this controversy. But besides that, I guess we look forward to the budget next week.
Moving on to segment two. So much for the independence of the PPSC, the Public Prosecution Service of Canada.
And so that's a direct quote, and we'll come back to where that comes from later. But let's start off with the latest in the SNC-Lavalin, Jody Wilson-Raybould ongoing controversy.
Yes, so the controversy continues to unfold with Monday with the Conflict of Interest and Ethics Commissioner announcing they were going to be investigating the situation. Trudeau at the Monday said he'd welcome that. I believe at the same press conference also made the bold proclamation that there is nothing to see here, and you should know that because Jody Wilson-Raybould's presence in cabinet speaks for itself. Flash forward to the day after, and Jody Wilson-Raybould is no longer in cabinet.
Yeah, she issued a short letter to the Prime Minister saying she's tendering her resignation as Minister of Veterans Affairs.
And Associate Minister of National Defense.
That's very important. She thanks Canadians and the residents of Vancouver Granville. She talks about veterans and their families. She talks about her officials and ministerial staff. She doesn't really thank anyone in the Prime Minister's office for ever having chosen her for any of these roles. And so it was a letter that didn't say a lot, but I think like most of Wilson-Raybould's past week and a half or 2 weeks has said a lot by not saying much.
Yes, and part of that is the solicitor-client privilege issue, which has not been resolved yet, but it turns out she's hiring some big guns to help her out with that in the form of retired Supreme Court Justice Thomas Cromwell.
I love that former Supreme Court justices just keep popping up in this country. Yakabuchi keeps, you know, showing up for things. It's just fun.
Who did SNC-Lavalin hire again?
I think they hired Iacobucci. Yeah. It's amusing. And I would never know what to do if I were, you know, counsel or something arguing a case and suddenly the other side had a former Supreme Court justice. And you're like, come on, that's not fair. He wrote the law. But Trudeau's reaction to Wilson Raybould's resignation, or in his words, Jody's, was characterized by the Union of BC Indian Chiefs and some of his other past comments and sort of staff leaks about her as discriminatory and sexist comments in an open letter they released this week, because he had this press conference where he talked about, you know, Jody never talked to me about wanting to resign. When I talked to Jody, things were going well. And he used her first name 3 or 4 times. And then he talks about how Minister Sajjan is going to take over the role of Veterans Affairs as an acting minister, in addition to being Minister of National Defense. So there's somewhat of a fit there. And it was just kind of petty, in a way, to keep using her first name and then to refer to the other minister. Like, her title is still the Honorable Jody Wilson-Raybould, and she keeps that until her death, as far as I know.
There are ways to lose it, but like, it has to be pretty bad.
You don't lose it by resigning. So, and at very least, you don't say one person's first name and the other's last name in a formal statement, where especially you're pissed at one of them. So it looked a little demeaning to a prominent Indigenous woman in cabinet, or formerly in cabinet. And so that drew some reaction. I guess her, Jody Wilson-Raybould's father, actually tweeted out wrote out a really scathing letter of the prime minister, which Wilson-Raybould then retweeted. So she's not necessarily saying it, but retweets are not endorsements. And then I guess a group of Indigenous senators led by Murray Sinclair, a liberal, but liberal in quotes because there's no liberals in the federal Senate anymore, put out a statement not as critical of the prime minister as the UBCIC, but still supportive of Jody Wilson-Raybould. And so it's kind of become this issue of, is Justin Trudeau just like all flash and good optics, but then the substance is just missing, whether it comes to reconciliation or women's issues or anything else he's promised for progressives? And so he's kind of losing that front in his whatever battle he's fighting, the battle to defend Quebec engineering giants.
Or more specifically, the battle to defend, well, connected engineering companies. Because if SNC folds, the jobs might not be there in the exact sense of the people who are currently employed by SNC-Lavalin may have to look for work. Like, the demand for them is still there. Like, the roads will still need to be built. You know, all the stuff SNC does will just be done by other companies who'll need to expand it and pick up that talent. So it's one of those things that you're supposed to have turnover in a market economy. And one of the things that should cause that is, well, being held accountable for massive corruption.
Yeah. Well, one of the ways to try to get to the bottom of this is inquiries. And you talked about the Ethics Commissioner investigation. The other possibility is the Federal Justice Committee. This is MPs who get together to, in theory, analyze legislation and hold the government to account. Committees are very valuable. Now, they also tend to be stacked by a majority of MPs representing the governing party, so they don't always work as effectively as they could. But the Justice Committee did decide to hold an investigation this week.
Yes, so they did agree to move forward on this, although not quite as forcefully as the opposition would like. They basically declined to speak to the key players in this. Like, they want to talk to, get witnesses to come in, just not the former Attorney General or PMO staffers.
Literally everyone involved, all the core characters of this drama. It's a necessary step, I guess. It's better than nothing.
Is it, though?
I don't know.
Like, if you're just going to...
A show trial?
Do a show trial, is that really better?
Yeah, you might be right. I think the other thing the opposition parties, the conservatives have been very good on this, and NDP are actually finding their feet on this, have both been saying, and you already referred to this solicitor-client privilege issue of, well, the clients, the government can waive it and tell us what's happened here, what's going on, clear some of this up. And maybe they'll end up passing a motion to, or at least trying to put a motion forward in Parliament, I guess.
Yeah, there is push them some precedent it. For this. Recently, the UK Parliament had their Attorney General be forced to release his legal opinion on some Brexit issues. And Parliament also, I think, forced the release of some national security stuff related to Afghanistan back in like 2011 or so. That kind of lends precedential weight to the idea that Parliament has the power to effectively waive this privilege.
Now that assumes you can get enough Liberal MPs to side with the opposition.
There has been some Liberal MPs who've made comments to the effect of, yeah, there's something here, we need to do more. So just today, Wayne Long from New Brunswick, yeah, he called for the former Attorney General and the PMO staffers to be included in the Justice Committee investigation. And, you know, so you're seeing some Liberals kind of breaking ranks, which in a system as... or a system with as tight party discipline as ours is notable. Whether or not that actually means there's enough votes to overrule the government's another question. And we've had some Liberal MPs taking the position that, yeah, they need to do more. We've also had some Liberal MPs who've been rather deferential to the PMO, including the chairman of the Justice Committee, the Chairman Housefather, who suggested that the reason that the former Attorney General was, well, made former Attorney General rather than keeping her post, was a lack of French language proficiency, and that there was some potentially upcoming legal issues in Quebec that needed a Francophone justice minister. I mean, there is a big legal issue in Quebec right now, but that's also kind of why we're having this problem. And, you know, 2 years in's a little late to discover that your Attorney General doesn't speak French.
Wow.
He got critiqued pretty hard for that and did walk it back a bit. But yeah, that's not a great look.
So the other not great look, and to bring it back to this quote of so much for the independence of the PPSC, being the PPSC is what's sort of at the center of the Wilson-Raybould SNC-Lavalin controversy and whether or not influence was pushed onto there, is this other ongoing controversy that we've touched on a few times in quick takes and otherwise, but I've still never really like gotten it into my heart as something that I care to actually fully understand. But it's this ongoing Admiral Norman trial. And the CBC article that we'll throw a link to in the show notes describes the latest turn of events as possibly a bigger scandal than the SNC-Lavalin issue. So what happened at the trial of Admiral Norman? And by trial, I mean pre-trial.
Yes. Because this hasn't actually gotten to the trial stage yet, because the big issue is what documents the defense gets access to. And there's been suggestions made by the defense team that that has had the PMO's fingerprints all over it in terms of deciding what gets released and what doesn't.
So this dates back again to the allegation that Admiral Norman leaked cabinet documents to a Quebec shipyard and a CBC journalist in 2015 about two-thirds of a billion-dollar shipbuilding deal, just trying to sort of stave it off. Not a good case for the government because they don't want to look like they're stomping on whistleblowers, or is he also just... It's complicated, right? Because shipbuilding's also kind of a racket in this country.
Yeah, and this is a question, you know, did they, you know, do their due diligence and everything, or were they trying to direct stuff to favored shipyard? Anyway, it's there's a lot of kind of political subtext underneath this, and it's a very political case. And earlier this week, the Norman defense team accused the government lawyers and PCO, the Privy Council office, of coordinating their legal strategy.
And again, the public prosecution is supposed to be independent of the Prime Minister's office. This is the exact same thing that's happening in the SNC-Lavalin case.
So there's documents that have been censored, haven't been released, and they're trying to get basically unredacted notes from meetings between the Privy Council office and Crown lawyers. The prosecutors have said that they can't release them because they contain trial strategy, which then, of course, has led to the accusation that, well, why are you discussing trial strategy with the government?
I mean, the defense's specific quote in court is, by all appearances, this is more direct influencing of the prosecution. The Attorney General is entirely bypassed. Again, Jody Wilson-Raybould cut out, and the government, the center of government, the executive, is going straight to the judicial or the prosecution and saying, do this. The Prime Minister's office, via its right arm, the Privy Council office, is dealing directly with the PPSC, the Public Prosecution Service of Canada, and the Prosecution Service is allowing this to happen. So this is said in the courtroom, and the judge, Heather Perkins McVeigh, cuts to the heart of the matter, saying, so much for the independence of the PPSC, if that's true. Not good. I mean, this hasn't been ruled on. These are
allegations. This is still a pretrial motion and everything, because we haven't even really kind of gotten to the meat of this yet. This is just, how much of the meat does the defense counsel get to look at? So this will likely be an ongoing issue, and one that could quite likely result in this actually going to trial much closer to the election.
Well, it's already scheduled or assumed to be the actual trial will happen in the summer, and the election's on October, so we likely won't get a result out of that, but more dirt will inevitably come out. So you have here two cases, one already in court and one about whether or not to go to court, where there are PMO fingerprints where they're not supposed to be on what the prosecution of this country is doing. Is Trudeau just bad at his job? Is he just like needing to control everything? Is that his modus operandi?
I'm not sure if it's Trudeau. It's, I would guess more would be kind of the next level down. You know, your Jerry Butts and Katie Telford. And, you know, the senior non-elected people at PMO.
Again, these are all the scandals that should happen in your second or third or fourth term of government. Not your first. You gotta be able to get through 4 years without getting corrupt and trying to curry favor and influence trials. God, rookie mistakes. Moving on to quick takes. The first bill of the BC legislature was the usual recognition of the supremacy of parliament, yada, yada, yada. The second bill, though, was the one I've been looking forward to, and the BC Civil Liberties Association has been looking forward to for a long time, and it's BC's anti-slap law. Credit to Shannon Waters of BC Today for taking this bill too, and the previous, I think it was Bill 32, I want to say, something like that.
I believe so.
And going line by line to find the differences, because the Attorney General who introduced it, David Eby, said, you know, they're basically the same, don't worry about it. She found the only change is the new legislation is only retroactive to lawsuits filed on or before May 15th of 2018. What's special about that date? That's when the other bill was introduced. And so if we don't have any word from the government about why that change, we know they didn't pass the anti-slap legislation because they were concerned about ongoing litigation related to other anti-slap laws, the only notable one being Ontario's and a weird case involving a former MLA and a member of the bureaucracy, and one was suing the other. It was messy. But it looks like the change is trying to stave off the criticism that, oh, I started this defamation suit before I knew I couldn't start this defamation suit. So that's not fair that I can't continue my defamation suit. It would be great if we could just throw out all slap lawsuits, but I could probably see some reason for this change, and honestly, I don't know defamation law in and out well enough to know if this is something we should be terribly worked up about, but it seems reasonable, and having a law is better than not having one, frankly.
Well, the other big news out of Victoria this week has been around the provincial crown corporations. Earlier this week, David Eby announced that ICBC was going to cap the number of experts allowed in vehicle injury claims. So for claims less than $100,000, you get one expert, and if it's more than that, you get three.
Seems pretty reasonable. I guess the situation we're running into is two people run their cars into each other, and both sides, or whoever gets injured more, their lawyers hire an expert to say, oh, this accident caused all of these things. And then the opposite side has to hire an expert to say, actually, it can't do all of those things. And then the first side hires another expert to say, no, it actually can. It's an arms race of experts. Who's got the most? And because ICBC is sometimes funding both sides of those lawsuits, it ends up costing a lot of money. So David Eby has said this could save the province $400 million a year. And given that ICBC is losing $900 million a year, this would be a big chunk of it. That does seem optimistic in the savings, but courts are expensive, right? Obviously, this has upset trial lawyers who always want to mount the strongest defense they can for their clients, and being able to bring lots of experts in seems like a better defense than not.
I mean, also, like, dealing with all of that, I imagine, increases one's billable hours.
Yeah. There is an exemption here that if you need more experts for whatever reason, maybe it is a complicated case, the judge can overrule these rules. I think the one point of possibly legit criticism that the Trial Lawyers Association and others have raised is these changes were made kind of unilaterally through an order in council just earlier this week. It was like overnight, it's no longer allowed to have more experts. And there wasn't a lot of consultation or feedback from what people are saying. I mean, anytime you end up with the result you disagree with, it's always easy to say I wasn't consulted, but maybe it was true in this case. But the other Crown Corporation that was losing a ton of money is BC Hydro. And there is a new review of the independent power projects that the previous government was a big fan of, looking into, were those a good idea? And my favorite part isn't the findings that the Liberals were clearly bad at it. It's that the title of the report is zapped. And all public policy reports need to have sparkier titles like that. Pun fully intended.
So in other words, the next MOTI one should be what, Zoom or something?
Well, and the ICBC one should just be crashed or something, you know, very simple. The conclusions with respect to IPPs are actually quite straightforward and blunt. BC Hydro bought too much energy with the wrong profile. They paid too much for the energy they bought, and they took those actions, buying the wrong electricity and spending too much on it at the direction of government. And this was pretty much all of the criticism everyone had for the BC Liberals and the IPP projects.
Yeah, just this is something that's actually been around since the 80s, but got ramped up around, I think, 2002, the report said.
And the idea itself isn't terrible. It's one the Greens are actually a big fan of. It's the idea of creating lots of smaller private power projects. A lot of Indigenous nations are actually really picking up on this, especially on green energy, whether it's run-of-the-river hydro, small-scale wind or solar, and just other creative ways to get a little bit more electricity out into the grid. Not a bad idea, unless you're totally pushing your thumb on the scale of which of those projects to do and forcing the provincial utility to buy too much power that it doesn't need.
Yeah, well, part of that was triggered by a requirement they put in at the time to require that BC be entirely self-sufficient on energy, which we're part of a regional grid. It doesn't have to be entirely self-sufficient. And, you know, just to the south of us is Washington that has like five dams alone on the Columbia River. There's like a regional energy market we can buy electricity from if we don't have to be, you know, everything right this second, or don't have to have the capacity to do everything at the highest load for ourselves.
And so the report also has a number of recommendations going forward to try to bring things back in order. I think the damning part of this is how much this is going to end up costing ratepayers, and it's not a small amount. It's in the billions of dollars over the next 20 years. So when you couple that with Site C and how much that's going to cost us, whether we build it or not, and the deferral accounts trickery that's been going on at BC Hydro, it keeps playing into this narrative that the NDP are so happy to talk up, which is the BC Liberals' mismanagement of all the Crown corporations. Now, whether the NDP can fix it is the next question. They keep trying their darndest with ICBC, and we'll see where they go with BC Hydro, but trying to bring electricity rates under control when you have all of these bungled decisions, it's going to be tough. Well, we're now sitting in my new place in Burnaby South. You probably walked when you were coming from the SkyTrain station past Jagmeet Singh's campaign headquarters with all the signs.
Yes, that's, in fact, about 50% of all the by-election signs I've seen so far have been at that
random empty building. And
at the headquarters there. I do work in Burnaby South, so the fact that like I haven't seen much in like the little northern corner I work in probably says something interesting too, but yeah, there's a lot of signs in this part of the city.
So one of the interesting stories to come out in Burnaby now, sort of interesting, it's not really, no offense, to Kelvin Gawley, who wrote this, for the Burnaby Now is that Kelvin looked at all the candidates running and where they actually live, and he figured out that Jagmeet Singh is the only candidate with a party name attached to him who actually lives in this riding, ironically, because he was parachuted in to live here, to run here. Conservative Jay Shin lives in Vancouver. Richard Lee lives in North Burnaby, where he was an MLA. Laura Lynn Thompson of the People's Party, whose signs you will see if you drive up and down Kingsway or anywhere you can put a sign without having to ask, essentially. Her signs are everywhere. She lives in New West. And Terry Grimwood, who's an independent, lives in Sechelt, that very Burnaby bit of the Sunshine Coast. There is one other independent running, Valentine Wu, who does actually live in the constituency, but Jagmeet can claim to be the like most prominent Burnaby Souther actually running in this race. But one thing that's come up, having lived now in this constituency for almost 3 weeks, which is not long enough to vote. I needed to be here by January 14th, and so I missed it by about 2 weeks, not 2 days. I did call Elections Canada and confirm that. Is I think the difference has been Jagmeet Singh has struggled on the national stage because he's obsessively thrown himself into this constituency and is doing door knocking himself, is doing like daily campaign events. And the reason he's missing out on major policy things like Venezuela or China is because he's too busy door knocking. And I think he did this during the leadership race as well, is he spent so much time just kind of focused on signing up new members and running the best leadership campaign he could that he sort of lost sight of other things. And now he's running the best by-election campaign he can, that he's losing sight of the national things, whether that's good or bad. It explains.
Like his job first and foremost is to lead the national party. And if you're, national party has terrible fundraising numbers, can't come out with a coherent message on are South American dictators bad, like there's stuff like that that it just hurts the party.
My prediction or thought though is that it's a bad long-term strategy if he's obsessed with Burnaby South, but I think turn February 25th, assuming he wins the by-election, his attention then becomes national, and then hopefully he starts to come out of his shell and focus on the national stage in the same obsessive way. And it's this obsession that's actually making me think he might hit 50% of the popular vote in Burnaby South in the by-election, which would be a jump of 15 to 20 for the NDP here, which would pretty quickly put to rest the, should he really be leader if he crushes the by-election?
Yeah, if it gets absolutely crushed, it might placate that a bit. But at the same time, like that, he did that whole cross Canada tour thing where you could like go on the website and like see the little jet animation go around, and that got him nowhere. So like being like a good retail politician in one small constituency isn't the same skill set as running a national party.
Yeah. It's just interesting to see. And you know, it's another 11 days until we know the results.
Well, another court case that has national implications that's been going on is the Saskatchewan government's challenge of the federal carbon tax has finally gone ahead, and the court has been busy hearing arguments this week. It's still early days in that, and we don't quite know where it's going to go, although I think the smart money for the smart, you know, constitutional scholar bets, I guess, are on it'll get upheld.
Can BC's Play Now online gambling website add betting on court cases? They do allow betting on US politics and some UK politics. There's no domestic stuff because I think there might be a law against that. I don't know if you're allowed to bet on court cases.
Probably not.
Definitely not if you're involved in it.
Yeah, it seems like it's the sort of thing that would probably be illegal.
I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying it'd be fun.
It might be one of those things nobody's thought to actually put in the law, but everyone just frowns on it so much.
Yeah, with any ongoing court case, it's interesting to watch, but sometimes the actual hearings make a difference. Sometimes on these kind of issues, it's all in the written submissions. Other times, it's just really what the judge wants to do. Or in this case, the judges. I believe it's the Court of Appeal. So yeah, up in the air. Courts seem pretty deferential to letting everyone in this country do things, especially the federal government.
Yeah, like the federal government has pretty clear taxation powers, so yeah, that's going to be a hard one for the province to overcome.
Well, the debates in the courtroom in Saskatchewan are going to be well-reasoned, well-argued, and rational.
Doug Ford has his representatives there, so maybe not entirely.
Yeah, but his lawyers are smarter, I hope. The place where there definitely won't be rational debate, as we know, is Twitter. And CBC has a nice report out where they analyzed 9.6 million tweets that were popular in Canada and found there were a large number of these troll accounts essentially making them that came from foreign sources, namely Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, they highlight, that were trying to gin up controversy over pipelines and immigration in particular, and also a bit on terrorism. These Twitter bots would go and retweet the CBC, obviously, and some of the other major news sites, but some of the other things that got retweeted second, third, and fourth were the Rebel Media's main Twitter account, Ezra Levant's Twitter account, and RT News, which I get Russia promoting RT News. That just feels like an ad campaign. But promoting the Rebel and Ezra Levant, like, how does he feel about that? Is he happy to get the extra exposure? Or does he care? I mean, it's all a grift, so it doesn't...
It's hard to say, yeah.
I think it's a good reminder to not believe anything you read on Twitter.
Also, like, if it's coming from RT or the Rebel, yeah, I also don't believe that. That's just as a good general heuristic.
It also highlights how these things tend to really get pushed up around controversies. When the Quebec mosque shooting happened, there were a bunch of tweets about immigration and terror. Some of the pipeline issues came up when it was in the news. So apparently the government's not really saying how much we're being driven by foreign influence, but we did just see them roll out their election interference task forces. So yeah, things to keep an eye on. The one other thing that you cannot keep an eye on, according to the Supreme Court of Canada, is teenagers' cleavage. At least if you're a teacher with a pen camera in your pocket. And if this sounds like it shouldn't need to be said...
Especially by the Supreme Court.
It did need to be said because two court levels below found a teacher in Ontario not guilty of voyeurism after he filmed multiple female students' cleavage. The teacher would basically put this camera in his pocket that's shaped like a pen, a spy cam, essentially, go and talk to a female student and sort of lean down so it looked down her shirt, and then save that. And so he had dozens of, like, 1-minute clips of this that was found on his pen. The trial court said, oh no, that's not voyeurism because we don't know he did it for a sexual purpose.
I feel like it's a fairly safe assumption to make.
The Court of Appeal got, like, there.
Courts shouldn't make assumptions, but you could probably make that assumption.
Yeah. If he was filming all day, maybe. It's still weird. The Court of Appeal found, yeah, it was pervy. But the student shouldn't have, at least a majority on the Court of Appeal said, the student shouldn't have a expectation that they're not being filmed in school by teachers with pen cameras in their pocket. And that's where the Supreme Court had to step in and say, no, actually, students should have some expectation of privacy. Not like a universal one at school, but you should expect that your teachers aren't filming your boobs, at a minimum. And this was a unanimous decision, although naturally, as we've noted, there had to be a concurring decision, which Cote and Brown had to be on. But this one was written by Malcolm Rowe, the newer justice, not the newest. So we have our natural alliances forming again. I just love this case because it's so ridiculous that it had to make it to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I also know, if you're ever tired or looking for more news coverage in BC, the College of Teachers regularly has to publish all of the disciplinary actions against teachers in this province. So you always find the worst stories there. And I guess sometimes those stories make it to the Supreme Court of Canada.
And that has been Politros. Find links to everything we talked about at politros.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know you think to support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politros. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.